Thanks for joining us on Battle Walks as we walk across the great battlefields of Europe. If you're enjoying the show, why not become a member? Every week, you'll receive exclusive bonus episodes available only to subscribers, and you can listen to all our episodes completely ad-free. Click on the link in the show notes to join us via Acast Plus.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A Living History production.
I'm Matt McLaughlin.
And I'm Pete Smith.
We're battlefield historians who love nothing better than getting out and walking the ground where great battles in history took place.
And now we'd like you to come with us. Every week, Battle Walks will take you to one of the great battlefields of Europe.
As we walk the ground, we'll dig through the pages of history, we'll uncover the secrets of the battlefields, and most importantly, we'll tell the stories of the people who fought and died there.
Welcome to Battle Walks.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of Battle Walks, where we are walking the great battlefields of Europe. If you haven't listened to our recent episodes, please go back and do that because we've had some absolute crackers. And I know someone who will agree with that. It's my wonderful co-host, Pete Smith. Pete, we're back.
Yep, and I'm crackers. Yes, we are. We're definitely back.
Mate, we've done something interesting here. This is not just a history podcast. It's also a space and time podcast. We have broken the space-time continuum because on the 20th of April, 2022, we said we will see you next week for the second part of our Suvla episode. And it's now a year later and we're only just getting back to it. So either something's shifted in space and time or we just got distracted and moved on with other things. But the point is we are now back doing the second part of our Suvla episode.
I actually had to listen to it to find out what I'd been talking about.
It was, you know, it's the hectic life of battlefield guides, isn't it? That there's always something new to discover. But thank you for hanging in there, dear listeners, for a year. If you were, I'm just imagining our poor listeners, Pete, sitting there with a cup of tea, going, "Oh, I'm really keen to hear the second part of our Suvla episode." So, look, if you don't know what we're talking about, go back a year to the 20th of April, 2022, and hear the first part of our Suvla episode in Gallipoli. But now I'm actually really looking forward to this, Pete, because this is one of my favourite areas of Gallipoli. Not particularly well visited. So I'm looking forward to getting stuck into it.
Yeah, me too. I enjoyed actually listening to us in the part one. I thought we were very good.
Sounds like we know what we're talking about occasionally.
It did.
Yeah. Last time what we actually did was it was a Suvla and North of Anzac tour, and we did the northern sector of Anzac at Gallipoli. And now we're going to do Suvla Bay proper, the Suvla sector. So there are, most people don't even realise, but there are three sectors, three areas of operations at Gallipoli. There's Anzac, famous for Australians and New Zealanders, the Helles sector, which gets a little bit overlooked by us Anzacs, and then, of course, Suvla from the landings in August. So we're not going to recount the entire history of the Gallipoli campaign, but just note that the Suvla landings were made as part of the August offensive, and do go back and listen to that previous episode because we explain in some detail what was going on. But the very quick overview is that as part of the huge August offensives, the Anzacs were attacking north of the Anzac sector, and the British launched a new landing at Suvla Bay, right up on the northern part of the peninsula, on the 6th of August, the same time the Aussies and New Zealanders and Brits were attacking in the mad tangle of gullies north of Anzac. So, I mean, the interesting thing to say here as well is that by the 7th of August, so a day after the landing, there were 20,000 British troops ashore at Suvla facing 1,500 Turks who had very little artillery and no machine guns whatsoever. And yet, the British, you know, it's very confused, the historic explanation as to what happened, but basically the British troops did not move forward quick enough, and the Turks were able to reinforce the hills around Suvla, and like Anzac, like Helles, it became a siege. So, I mean, Pete, have you ever seen a decent explanation as to why the British just didn't move forward and capture that high ground?
I think it's confusion. Confusion reigned. You can feel it when you read battalion kind of histories. And also there's a bit of a blame thing going on. You know, battalions are trying to explain why they didn't move forward, what went wrong, and they're blaming the battalion to the left or to the right. And that battalion is blaming somebody else. It's just a mess. It's just a complete lack of planning, lack of maps, lack of preparation. And lack of drive in some cases. I mean, there are stories of the men kind of almost not very happy to get off the boats. They've landed, they've got these new beetles, they should be kind of easy to get ashore. They're not getting ashore, they're grounding on the reefs, and the guys won't get out because they're not under particularly heavy fire. So, yeah, it's a mess right from the start. It's a mess, and it will continue to be a mess as the campaign unfolds.
Well, doing my research for this episode, Pete, I was just, I mean, flabbergasted is the word. So Suvla Bay is a big flat plain surrounded by a ridge of hills. So it looks down like an amphitheater. Now, the one thing I should say in defense of the British is the ground is deceptive, Suvla Bay. If you are looking at it from Anzac, for example, you can see the whole thing. It just looks flat as a pancake and it looks like a parade ground. When you get there, which we're going to do on this walk, it's absolutely fascinating. And the first time I went there, Pete, I was astounded by how many little gullies and washaways and hidden little valleys. And it's some tough country. If I said to you, to anyone, start at the beach and walk to the hills, they would be exhausted and wrecked by the time they got there. It is a confusing country to cross.
It's also, the descriptions of it are confusing because quite often they just talk about the salt pans or the salt plains, and you just get this vision of very, very flat, unbelievably flat, and they just got across this flat ground and then assault the hills. And as you said, that's not it at all. But even the information that you get, you know, you can imagine the guys being told, you know, when we get off the boats, guys, it's going to be flat. You've got these salt plains to cross these, the salt pans and attack the ridges. There's very few Turks here. It's going to be and it just develops into a complete mess of people not knowing where people are, disappearing to gullies. Just horrendous.
The other frustrating thing was that some of the really important hills actually were captured by the British early on in the landings, soon after landing. Yep. But because of the confusion, because everyone was disorganized, they made a not insensible decision to consolidate, to get everyone together and get everyone sorted out. But that meant abandoning hills that the Turks then occupied and that they would then lose thousands of men trying to retake. So, I mean, it's all the stories of Gallipoli are frustrating, but this one in particular. I just wanted to read a quote here before we get started. This was a German perspective. This is Kannengeisser, the German commander who was in charge of a lot of the Turks. And he wrote an excellent book, which is translated into English in the 20s. So certainly look that up. But he's got some excellent accounts from the Turkish high command point of view. This is what he saw on the morning of the 7th of August. Suvla Bay lay full of ships. We counted 10 transports, 6 warships, and 7 hospital ships. On land, we saw a confused mass of troops like a disturbed antheap. And across the blinding white surface of the dried salt sea, we saw a battery marching in a southerly direction. I saw English troops on the Lala Baba and on the flat in certain places entrenching. Nowhere was there fighting in progress. So I think that's a fantastic description of how confused it was. Why was an artillery battery going south? That's completely the wrong direction. Lala Baba is a hill that they occupied early on, one of the few hills. I love his terms, a confused mass of troops like a disturbed antheap. That sums it up pretty well. He might be being slightly harsh on the British, but it certainly sums up that feeling from the Turks that they had an opportunity to reinforce.
I think it's a good description.
Well, it's a frustrating walk, this one. We're going to, I think, if you're listening to this, I think you're going to be shaking your head as much as Pete and I are when we visit a number of these sites and hear what went on there. There's no glory at Suvla, but it's a place that should be visited. Not enough people go there. Most people don't go there when they go to Gallipoli. It's hard to visit. The roads are bad. It's a long way north. So you really have to seek it out. But I would say to everyone listening, when you go and walk the ground for real, absolutely include Suvla. I as a historian and a tour operator, I don't let people go to Gallipoli and not go to Suvla when I'm putting itineraries together and people are wanting to save time or focus more on Anzac. I say, no, you've got to go to Suvla as well. You can't understand the full story of Gallipoli until you've visited Suvla. That's what we're going to do today.
It's one of my favourite places, Matt, I have to say. I enjoy exploring that open vista because we're so used, if you're used to kind of exploring or you've been to Anzac Cove and you get that the tightness of it and how close everything is, and suddenly it's not like that. It's very open, you can see the ridges in the distance, and so it's a very different perspective from the one that we normally, especially from an Australian or New Zealand perspective, of those ridges that we're trying to get to the top of. This is not quite that.
And you certainly don't have to worry about crowds when you're up there, Pete.
No, you don't. That's absolutely sure. Yeah, dogs is probably the only thing.
Yeah, the wild dogs, and you see a lot of shepherds up there, or goat herders up there, and they're always appreciative of a little bit of company. It's some lonely territory up in the northern part of the peninsula, but it's a great area, and this is going to be a great walk. So let's kick off. We finished at Hill 60, right in the north of Anzac, the delineation point between Anzac and Suvla. And we're going to head north from there. I mean, Hill 60, one of our favourite spots to visit at Gallipoli, and the story really begins and ends at Hill 60. And we're going to head off from there, and just a little bit north of Hill 60 Cemetery is an intersection with a few cemetery signs pointing in various directions. And this is the start of Suvla, the start of the bumpy roads. If it's been wet, you often won't be able to get through to these cemeteries, which is quite unusual for Commonwealth War cemeteries, Pete.
It is.
That Commonwealth cemeteries are traditionally built in accessible areas. This is certainly not the case here. Many of these cemeteries are inaccessible, and these sites are inaccessible if it's been raining. So the suspension on your car will get a good workout during the Suvla tour. That's all part of the adventure. So what we're going to do... Go on, Pete.
No, I was just going to say, you never know nowadays, do you? There's so many changes taking place at the moment that I was just thinking, I wonder if the roads are still like that. I haven't been for a couple of years, so you never know, do you? We'll have to have a word with Craig there and see if he knows whether the roads are still difficult or whether they've been improved.
Yeah, it's a great point. I haven't been to Gallipoli for a few years. 2019 was the last time I was there. So, if you're listening to this and you've been recently to Suvla, let us know. Contact us on Facebook or Twitter.
Yeah.
Tell us what it's like. I assume the roads are still terrible. They have been since the campaign.
Me too. I kind of hope they are, really, because part of the enjoyment to me is getting there. It's an adventure to get there.
I agree entirely. So we're going to turn left at the big intersection of signs, and we're going to head. There's a hill in the distance that we're going to drive towards. We go past there's a well, an old fashioned well that was actually used during the campaign. It's worth stopping at as well. But we're heading for the hill, and what we're actually heading for is a cemetery called Lala Baba Cemetery. So the hill just next to the cemetery was the hill called Lala Baba that was referred to in that previous quote. And it was really the first high ground captured on the, pretty much as soon as the troops came ashore. Yeah. And the cemetery is a good, interesting spot to get a good perspective, on the landing beaches and the early phases of the Suvla campaign. And Pete, you wanted to talk specifically about some of the units that came ashore here.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. Lala Baba, to a lot of the men that fought there, was known as Yorkshire Hill, which gives you a clue, really, of who's going to be taking Lala Baba. It's the 11th Northern Division, which in the main was a Kitchener division. So these are the first of the Kitchener men, in fact, to go into action. And I just was going to run through the 32nd Brigade, which was actually involved in the taking of Lala Baba, and just to get the names of the units involved. So 9th Battalion West Yorkshire Regiment, 6th Battalion Yorkshire Regiment, 8th Battalion West Riding Regiment, 6th Battalion York and Lancaster Regiment, and the Pioneer Battalion was the 6th Battalion of the East Yorkshire Regiment. So you get the gist of the Yorkshire Hill. It is predominantly Yorkshire regiments and battalions, and they are all Kitchener men. So all Kitchener's pointing finger, so all volunteers. This is part of the volunteer army.
There's a neat dovetail here, Pete, with something we talked about a couple of weeks ago. We did the first day on the Somme in the area around Serre and the Sheffield Memorial Park. Are these the same men that would fight in that area on the 1st of July, Pete?
That's a very good question. And the simple answer is, in some cases, I would say, yes, they are. But I'm not quite sure where they are at that period.
It's not specifically the ones that we followed around Sayre, but
no, it's not. No, it's not.
But this is Kitchener's new army, the Yorkshire, you know, the Yorkshire battalions. They absolutely would have fought the 1st of July. So it's a question where.
Most definitely, the 11th Division certainly did fight during the Somme. I'm not sure whether they were engaged on the 1st of July. Somebody will know straight away. And in fact, if I reach across and have a look at the book, which I'm not going to do, I can quickly check myself. But yeah, they were certainly on the Somme, definitely. Whether they were engaged on the 1st of July, not sure.
The interesting thing about Lala Baba, Pete, that I always like as well, is it wasn't just the scene of the landing at Suvla. It came into the history before that. It's one of the things I love about the Gallipoli story. Because the lines didn't really move very much during the whole campaign, every patch of ground has dozens of stories about it, and Lala Baba is no exception. Because really early in the campaign, in fact, the first week of the campaign, on the 2nd of May, there was a Turkish observation post up on Lala Baba, which was looking down, because of the big curve of Suvla Bay, it was actually looking effectively into the back of Anzac Cove, and they were observing and directing artillery fire down there. And so in one of the most underrated actions, I think, of the campaign, the New Zealanders launched a raid on Lala Baba on the 2nd of May. Now, this is ludicrous. It's so far in Turkish territory. This is, you know, how many months? This is 3 months before the Suva landings. This is so audacious. They went up in boats. They landed on the shore where the same beaches where the British would come ashore in August. And they crept up and they attacked and overcame the post at Lala Baba. Just extraordinary. I want to read the account here, and then I want to get your opinion, Pete. So they came ashore in boats, and this is the quote. They crept in three groups up the side of Lala Baba. In a trench immediately below the crest, they surprised 21 Turks asleep. These, on being disturbed, fired a few shots. Several were killed and 15 captured. The New Zealanders searched the hill. They found a machine gun emplacement, blew up several huts, destroyed the telephone wire, and embarked before midday without interference from the enemy. I mean, that's just, that's predating the commandos. That's, you know, we talked in our Guadalcanal episode about the long patrol, the Marine Raiders. That's an extraordinary feat of arms, Pete.
Well, it's an extraordinary feat just for the navigational ability. You know, we looking at the landings that take place with the 11th Northern Division, where they have no idea what's what, they get confused, they're lost. I mean, these guys on a little raid manage to get straight to the right place, do exactly what they're supposed to be doing, and leave. Just extraordinary, you have to say.
You must admire them as a former commander yourself, mate.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, it's a fantastic kind of operation, a minor operation, but does exactly what it's supposed to do. Extraordinary.
A shout out to the Kiwis. I tell you what, at Gallipoli and on the Western Front, wherever there was a tough job, you could rely on the Kiwis, couldn't you? I mean, look back to our episode on Le Quesnoy, or Le Quinoa, as we know it's pronounced. I mean, just the balls on the Kiwis, mate. They never fail to impress me.
No, it's an extraordinary feat of arms.
Heading back to Lala Baba and specifically the cemetery, you made the good point, Pete, that the landing in this area was completely unopposed, but it didn't mean the fighting in isolated pockets was, and there was actually some quite stiff fighting to capture the hill where the cemetery now is.
Yeah, the 6th Yorkshire Regiment and the 9th West Yorkshire Regiment had terrible casualties, so I've just scribbled down the notes for these. So 6 officers and 25 other ranks in the 9th West Yorks. Now, what's fascinating about that is the high casualty rate for the officers. 6 officers and 25 other ranks. And then for the 6th Yorkshires, 11 officers and 56 other ranks. So this is actually junior officers leading from the front. Now, we still haven't got the hang of let's camouflage the officers so they look like the men, so they're not such obvious targets. At this period, they're still not doing that. So officers stood out, and we know the marksmanship of the Turkish snipers was excellent. So they are literally picking off the officers who are leading from the front, and hence we get this very quickly, get the confusion, because if you've lost your officers and they're the only people that have been given the full brief, if they have, on where they're supposed to be going, then the men start milling around. And we can see in a lot of cases senior NCOs, warrant officers, taking charge of these groups of men who have lost their officers.
And the first action for these men as well, we should recall. These men have probably trained for 6 months, and then now here they are. So when your lieutenant, who you followed through thick and thin for 6 months of training, gets a bullet in the head in the opening minutes, that's going to throw you out of out of your routine pretty quickly. And there's a really good example actually in the cemetery. So the cemetery was created after the war. Let's do the stats on the cemetery. Most of the cemeteries at Suvla were created after the war. There were obviously battlefield burials, but most of them have been consolidated into these mini concentration cemeteries. Compared to what we see on the Western Front, these cemeteries are relatively small, but it's the same principle of bringing in bodies from outlying graves and smaller cemeteries. So there's 216 burials in Lala Baba Cemetery. 53 are unidentified. So again, a small cemetery, but a concentration cemetery made after the war. And like all the Gallipoli cemeteries, curious decision, but they don't mark the unknown graves. So often you will go into a cemetery and there'll only be a handful of headstones, but the cemetery is full of men. It's only the men with a known identity who are marked with a headstone. And I in some ways, I find that disappointing, Pete. I think that if you walked in, a lot of people just don't realize. They think there's only six men buried in the cemetery, and they don't realize they're standing on unmarked graves. I probably, if it was up to me, would have preferred to have seen every grave marked like they do on the Western Front. But that was their decision. I think it illustrated the disaster that was Gallipoli if you had a cemetery where you'd go, we have 554 burials, of which six are known and the rest are completely unknown. There would be an awful lot of unknown headstones.
Yeah. They also, I think it's a nature of, it's a nature of having to abandon the sites for most of these cemeteries as well. It meant that quite often the markers got lost. So, for example, here, the commanding officer of the 6th Battalion of the Yorkshire Regiment was actually killed, Lieutenant Colonel Edward Chapman. He actually will lose his life. Now, he is buried in the cemetery, but yet we don't know where. So he's got a headstone, but he's buried somewhere within the cemetery. They're not even quite sure where he is within the... Well, not even quite. They have no idea where he is within the in the cemetery. I'm just going to read a little bit more about him here, because this is part of the letter that was sent by the battalion chaplain to his father. He died as he would have wished to die, a gallant soldier leading his men, himself at the very front of the regiment on the summit of Lala Baba. Despite the hail of bullets and the shower of shrapnel which had now got the range, the Yorkshires pushed forward to the Turkish trenches on the crest of the hill. There it was that the colonel's gift of leadership made themselves felt. "Come on, the Yorkshires," he cried, and at their head, with fixed bayonets, the lads he trained so well swept forward with irresistible force, and the hill was ours. He was unfortunately killed, as was his cousin, Captain Wilfred Chapman, 6th Yorkshires, was also killed on the 7th of August, and they're both buried within the cemetery.
The thing I think is most interesting about that, Pete, and harks back to your description of the officers being killed, leading their men from the front, was that Lieutenant Colonel Chapman is not the most senior officer buried in that cemetery, which is quite extraordinary, because lying not far away is Brigadier General Paul Kenner, VC, is buried there, who had won the VC in the Sudan in 1898. I won't read the full citation, but he rescued a number of wounded chaps and got them out of heavy fire and was awarded the VC for that. He was then killed by a sniper at Suvla. Yeah. So later in a couple of weeks after the landing. But again, you know, you're looking there at a brigadier general hit by a sniper leading from the front. So, I mean, again, it goes against the idea of the chateau general, safe and warm while the men are doing all the fighting, but it also illustrates that point very well, how many officers went down in the fighting at Suvla.
Yep. We also have, I'm just going to read a couple more of the people that I know are in here. I mean, there are so many, everybody's important, but there are so many well-known people in a lot of these small cemeteries. And again, it's a loss to the world of the potential of these people. So another one, in this case, it's a sportsman, Captain Robert Randerson, 6th Battalion of the Yorkshire Regiment again. And he was an outstanding sportsman. He played for Batley in Northern Union rugby football. He was also a teacher, and he'd been commissioned just before the war. And then very sadly, we have the young lads as well. Number 12522, Private Thomas Parkinson, 9th West Yorks. And he was killed on the 7th of August in 1915, and he was aged just 16.
There's also a couple of 17-year-olds in here, Pete, and several 18- and 19-year-olds. So there's two or three 17-year-olds. So a 16-year-old, several 17-year-olds, a couple of 18- and 19-year-olds. All new army men as well.
Yeah. Volunteers.
Tragic. And we should remember that Kitchener's new army, we think about the destruction on the 1st of July 1916, but for some of the units, Gallipoli was their first action, and what an action it was. They got absolutely smashed at Suvla. So, we should spare a thought for those poor buggers. The other thing I wanted to say is if you go to the back of the cemetery and stand up on the wall, you could actually look out. This is probably the best spot to get a view of the landing beaches and where the British came ashore. So it's a really good perspective. And they had all the usual problems of landing. Some of the beaches were quite an easy run in, but the ones particularly in front of this cemetery, there were a lot of sort of rocky shoals out, and that meant the boats grounded quite early. So it was a good thing that the landing was unopposed. Effectively unopposed, because otherwise it could have been quite a disaster. And I have another quote here. This is describing the landing in this sector. The run-in took less than 10 minutes, but how different from Anzac. The landing was a complete surprise. There was no opposition and not a single casualty. A few rockets were fired and one or two rifle shots rang out in the darkness, but that was all. Our motor lighter grounded rather far out, making it necessary for the men to wade in about 3 feet of water. They made a poor showing, no dash and a certain amount of talking. Indeed, a handful, who obviously had the wind up, looked as if they were afraid to land. Petty Officer Main sang out and told them to get a move on. They went ashore after that. And I should have mentioned this is by an Australian who was attached to the British and had obviously landed on the first day at Anzac. That sums up pretty much what we were talking about, Pete, that there was a certain reluctance to get ashore. Leadership. It probably comes down to leadership from the highest levels that there wasn't this drive, this imperative to keep moving inland quickly and secure that high ground, and that was a terrible blunder.
I'm going to read another first-hand account out here. Now, this one is one in my own collection, so this is one that's never been published.
Oh, excellent!
And it's from a private Jack Gulthorpe of the Lancashire Fusiliers. Again, part of the 11th Division, his 9th Battalion. Sadly, he will lose his life a few days after he wrote this account and sent it home to his wife. So, dear wife and children, I write these few lines hoping to find you all in good health as it leaves me at present. Also to let you know that I am where the fighting is going on. We left the last place last Friday and came here. Of course, he cannot say where exactly where he is. There were no troops here before, and we had to make a new landing. All went well until the boat got no further, and then the Turks started firing at us, and we had to wade ashore. We were up to the waist in water, and what with them firing at us, and us not being able to see them, it was a warm time. But I came through all right, and then on Saturday we shifted them a bit further away, but we lost a lot of men. And we have been fighting ever since, till yesterday, the first time I've had chance to write. I was thinking of home on Saturday, the first morning here, and thinking about it being the holidays. I thought to myself that I was having a warm one, but never mind, we are still living and here to tell the tale, and that is something to be thankful for. I thank the Lord on Saturday that I came through all right. I don't think it will be as bad again, at least I hope not. Remember me to all at home. Kiss the children for me and give them my love. I have not time to write more, so I will conclude with the fondest of love to you and the children from your ever-loving husband, Jack. And at the end is put, P.S. Write back to the same address. Remember me to your Albert and his wife. God be with you all. We will meet again. Jack, with love. And sadly, he was killed on the 21st of August.
We hadn't discussed this beforehand. I hadn't heard it. As you were reading that, I was going, please tell me he made it. Those ones. Yeah. Oh, as a dad, I mean, wow.
Yeah, terrible. No. Yeah. I actually have his medals and his death plaque as well, and I look after them and revere them. So I kind of keep his memory alive here in this house.
Oh, that's a wonderful account, Pete. Thank you for that. Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm not quite sure what to say after that. Wow. But we must push on as the Brits did themselves. We must keep moving forward. And wow, we're going to head back to the intersection, and we're going to now drive to another cemetery, which is a little bit further inland, which is Green Hill Cemetery. And even though we've just driven there pretty smoothly, the advance for the British was horrific. And that one sums it up, that the Brits were trying to move forward and the Turks quite artfully had concealed snipers. It was really the only way they could stop them. These probably technically weren't snipers. They were just infantrymen who were good with a rifle. They just nominated, okay, you know, you're going forward because we know you can shoot well and hold them up as best you can. But it all, the whole story plays into each other here because they were very good at picking the officers and hitting the officers. And so it was quite a treacherous progression forward, and the Brits would go out, send little patrols out to try and find the snipers. And I've got a quote here, I won't read the whole thing, but the end of it is, parties would go out voluntarily in search of these fiends, but all to no good, for generally they would return with the majority of the missing victims to the snipers. So just imagine what that means in an advance. You're just trying to move forward and officers are getting picked off, men are getting hit, sometimes from the side, sometimes from behind if you bypass one of these positions inadvertently. There was no cohesive line of advance, so small parties were going forward. Just a very tough way to fight. And it's going to lead us to Green Hill Cemetery. And these are two hills side by side, rather confusingly named, but in the end we settled on Green Hill for the one that was green and Chocolate Hill for the one that was covered in brown scrub. And effectively, these two hills mark pretty much as far as the British got in this part of the line during the whole campaign. And then after the war, as they did in many places in an important position, they built a cemetery. They brought in graves from isolated posts. Unlike Lala Baba, we were just at, this is a big one, 2,971 graves. And of those, once again, 2,472 unidentified. So only, 500 out of the nearly 3,000. Have an identity. So again, this cemetery, Pete, always strikes me as it reminds me the most of Western Front cemeteries, even though it's at Gallipoli, because it has a cross of sacrifice. It's laid out in a way that reflects the Western Front cemeteries, and there's a couple of very interesting graves in here.
I think also as well that enormous number of unidentified we kind of here on the Western Front associate with Passchendaele, where so many are lost on the battlefield, and it's no different here. Now, most of these graves going to be, this is a concentration cemetery, so created after the war when they literally went out and found the human remains either buried or not, and not in a lot of cases, and brought them in. And of course, if these bodies have been out in the open since 1915, this is late 1918, 1919, and so chances of identifying a lot of them, well, almost nil.
Well, there's a couple of very interesting graves in the cemetery that I did want to focus on. Probably one of the most fascinating is there's a Lieutenant William Niven in the cemetery. Yeah. And you may say, that's a familiar surname. Yes, this was David Niven, the actor's father, who was reported missing on the 21st of August. You'll notice, again, as an aside, that this date, the 21st of August, keeps coming up. The Brigadier General Kenner was killed on the 21st of August. Your friend that you just gave his sad account of, Pete, he was killed on the 21st of August. David Niven's father was killed on the 21st of August. There were some very big attacks on that date, which we'll come to later on. But I think that's an interesting one. David Niven grew up without a father. His father had been killed at Gallipoli. But here is what David Niven wrote about his father in his famous autobiography, The Moon's a Balloon. So David Niven wrote, "My sister and I were swapping cigarette cards on an old tree trunk in the paddock when a red-eyed maid came and told us our mother wanted to see us and that we were not to stay too long. After a rather incoherent interview with my mother, who displayed a telegram and tried to explain what missing meant, we returned to the swapping of cigarette cards and resumed our perusal of endless trains lumbering along a distant embankment loaded with guns and cheering young men."
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness,
because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
A couple of interesting things to take from that. It was a fairly aristocratic environment he grew up in.
I mean, it's a great account of how children are, I suppose, are, what's the word I'm looking for? They can cope with all sorts of information because it just doesn't mean a great deal. And I suspect with one of these families where father was probably not there an awful lot anyway, that it wouldn't have the impact that perhaps it would have nowadays on a family where the father is always present. Now, that's maybe been a bit unkind. Just a final thing to say, if you haven't read The Moon's a Balloon, it's an excellent book, one of my favourite autobiographies. It's well worth reading.
Yeah, I haven't read it for a number of years, but it's a great read. One of the other things I thought was interesting is there is a... I saw a letter in while doing this research that Mrs. Niven had received from someone at the War Office, which advised that... it reported that Lieutenant Niven had been seen advancing and had been shot in the head. But then rather optimistically added, this does not exclude the possibility of your husband having been taken prisoner by the Turks. Technically, that is true.
Yes,
true.
It is.
However,
yeah,
it seems unlikely. Yeah. And as reflected in that account, he was missing and is buried here in the cemetery. I'm just looking, does he have a grave? No, he's on a special memorial. So they know that he was buried here, but they don't know which grave he's in.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really interesting. That was a fascinating account. One of the other ones, again, tugs at the heartstrings. There's a shot at dawn here, Pete. One of the graves we always like to visit are the men shot at dawn, men executed for cowardice or desertion or, you know, one of the most barbaric chapters of the whole First World War is the execution of men in your own ranks. But this one's particularly moving. So this is Private Harry Salter was executed a week before the evacuation as well. So terrible. So this is an account of his last moments. This youth, barely 19 years of age, was shot by 12 of his comrades for taking French leave from his regiment on two occasions and attaching himself to the Anzacs. So deserting, basically. Not by any stretch of imagination could my comrades or I catalogue it as desertion, as 'twas impossible to desert from the peninsula, even had he so desired. I was one of the firing party. He was marched from a dugout about 80 yards away to a kind of disused quarry where the final scene was enacted. A clergyman preceded the doomed youth and his escort reading prayers for the dying, the mockery of it all. The doomed youth was tied up to a stake, his grave already dug. His last request was, "Don't blindfold me." What followed, I'll leave to the reader's imagination. In other words, I'll pull the pall of oblivion over the ghastly scene, if I can ever forget it. I only wish that the distinguished person who signed the death warrant, without taking into consideration extenuating circumstances, would leave his comfortable island residence and visit the men under his command who are going through it all. Well, we'd have a bit more faith in our leaders and confidence in ourselves. Wow, that is quite a statement. And the man who signed the death warrant, of course, he's referring to there is General Hamilton, who was over on over on Imbros and not on the peninsula. So, wow, that's don't blindfold me were his last words.
Yeah.
Horrific.
I just think
horrific.
I think it's so extraordinary when you think, yes, he couldn't go anywhere. So it isn't like he deserted, no. And normally desertion means that you leave your identity discs, your rifle, all of that, your military paraphernalia behind. And that's seen as true desertion. But I bet in this case he didn't, because he's not going anywhere other than a little bit along the coast. So it's just very, very, very sad. A sad little story.
I tell you what, things must have been bad at Suvla if he decided that the place he would prefer to be was Anzac. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So those Australians, he knew that he'd be hidden. He'd be hidden amongst them. Yeah.
There's one other story here in a grave that I always like to visit when I'm in this cemetery, because Pete, I know you and I share a fascination and a great interest in the pilgrims that came after the war to visit graves. So family members coming to visit graves, or most movingly, I think, ex-comrades, people who served here coming back to the battlefields. You know, I'd love to be transported back in time and be there to see the veterans coming back, which they did in great numbers, particularly in the 60s and 70s. They seemed to come back in large numbers then. But there is a grave here that I like to visit of Gunner Charles Crisp, because he was visited by his good mate, who was Sergeant George Dale, in 1971. And this is what George wrote about visiting Gallipoli. The most impressive cemeteries were Lancashire Landing at Helles, Lone Pine at Anzac, and Green Hill at Suvla. In the latter, I paused over a name, for there lies quiet, decent Charlie, moved from where we laid him below Chocolate Hill. Charlie never knew our brave new world of strikes and demos. He missed the slump, another world war, and several cold ones. Charlie never watched telly, nor saw an honest Bob become 5 new pence. All that trouble and strife he missed. Ah, but life is sweet. Rest in peace, old pal.
It's just a fantastic quote, is that? It's just, fantastic it was recorded. No, I just think it's wonderful.
He also gives a good indication of what life was like in Britain in the 70s. Strikes and strikes and slumps and demonstrations. Austerity gone wild. But I love that quote.
I'd like to say I can't remember, but sadly I can.
I really love that quote. What a lovely sentiment. What a lovely sentiment. So, Green Hill, it's a great spot to visit. I always like going there, and it does feel very similar to the cemeteries not far from where you are, Pete, on the Western Front. It's a good spot.
Yeah, it is.
Okay, so we're going to leave now. We're going to head again to another cemetery. The key points on the battlefields tend to be marked by cemeteries at Suvla. And this one's Hill 10 Cemetery. Now, this is down a very rough track, and often it's inaccessible. But if the weather is clear, as it is for us today, Pete, we're going to head down there. Yep. I should say, as an aside, the first time I did this tour, when I was putting the book together, I did it with Kanan Celik, the wonderful Gallipoli guide. And we did it in my little crappy hire car that I'd picked up in Chidakali. It was a bomb. And it was not a four-wheel drive by any stretch of the imagination, but we took it places that only a four-wheel drive would normally get to. And it was even in worse condition when I dropped it back at the depot. But my goodness, we got to some places. But I remember bumping down the track towards Hill 10 as one of the greatest adventures of our tour of Gallipoli. But this is a really fascinating cemetery. Another concentration cemetery made after the war, 699 burials. Only 150 unidentified here, which is a small proportion. So a lot of known graves here. I think we're in an area where there were hospitals and various things. So a bit more chance of identifying the burials. So it's an interesting cemetery. Interestingly, Pete, graves from the Newfoundland Regiment here in the cemetery, which is fascinating. We've talked about them a few times in our Somme episodes, because famously they attacked at the Newfoundland Memorial Park. Well, the site that is now the Newfoundland Memorial Park on the Somme, one of the most visited spots on the Western Front. And everyone's got a bit of a soft spot for the Newfoundland Regiment. And this was actually their first action, though. It wasn't the 1st of July, as most people think. It was here at Suvla Bay. Interesting unit, Pete.
Yeah, very interesting. Just battalion strength. So it's a regiment, but it's just one battalion. Newfoundland, not a very big population, but will serve throughout the whole of the war. Now, of course, Newfoundland part of Canada. And in fact, almost from my window, I can see one of the caribous that commemorate their places of action. And there's one being placed on the peninsula. I don't know where it is, Matt. Do you know where it is? I have no idea. They just recently put up a memorial to the
family. It might be here. For all I know, it might be here.
Yeah, I'm sure one of our listeners will know. But yeah, inaugurated maybe a couple of years ago. I think it was inaugurated during COVID, actually. That's probably why I don't know exactly where it is, because we wouldn't have been since then. So it's now commemorating their service here.
Yeah, that's excellent to see. I love those memorials.
Yeah, me too. Of course, this is if he has a grave, which we hope he has, because he's actually commemorated as one of the missing on the Helles Memorial. But the accounts are the last letter home by Jack Goldthorpe. He will lose his life attacking Hill 10. It was taken by the 9th Battalion Lancashire Fusiliers, of which he's a part of. I like to think that perhaps he's buried in this cemetery.
Highly likely, you'd think, of all the places he could be buried. Yeah. He might be one of those 150 unknowns. But
I'm just going to read... Yeah,
go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, sorry, Matt. No, I'm just going to read another account. This is a battalion that's passing over this ground. So this is the 7th Battalion of the Royal Dublin Fusiliers. The pals arrived at Hill 10 to find it has been taken by another battalion. So the final advance on Chocolate Hill began, with several hundred soldiers from other Irish regiments and a considerable number of troops from the 11th. They headed off across the Salt Lake bed in an easterly direction, then ran over a couple of empty water courses, through a number of dry ploughed fields before crawling through the hedgerows. The troops now entered a network of empty but well-constructed trenches at the base of Chocolate Hill. So this is actually attack on Chocolate Hill, but it's just interesting because it gives you an indication of what the landscape was like, which some men assumed had been built under German supervision. The enemy strategically withdrew to the very top of the hill. Now it was time for a wild and heart-stopping charge to the summit, using both bayonet and bullet. Even those who were not in the vanguard of the assault could see that an officer was signalling the men for the off with a green cloth tied to a stick. Then with a deafening roar and a concerted rush, the Dubliners stormed Chocolate Hill. To many of the pals, it looked like and sounded like a gigantic version of a forward rush on the rugby field at Dublin's Lansdowne Road. By the time the pals had reached the top, all the Turkish defenders had either been bayoneted or shot or had fled into the distance. Dead bodies lay in the brushwood on the hilltop that looked like a volcanic landscape in places, thick with smoke and pockmarked with craters of shells sent over earlier by British naval gunners. It was a bleak and lifeless scene, but the Dublin pals had helped the Irish division to take its first objective, and there was an intense satisfaction for many of the men in that fact. Now, it's read slightly out of sequence for what we're doing, but it started at Hill 10. And I just thought it was an excellent example of the landscape. It really describes the landscape very well.
Yeah, it's a great account, Pete. Thanks for that. It's it sums up all those things that we talk about at Suvla with dry water courses, ploughed fields, hedgerows. I was forgetting the hedgerows. They're not even really planted hedges. They're just these scrubby little barricades. We saw a couple of them at Hill 60 on the last walk. They're terrible. We still have to get through them today, and you want to wear long sleeves when you do because they scratch you to bits. It's rugged country. It's deceptively rugged. Another thing I like to note about this cemetery is there's actually three Australians buried here, which is highly unusual for the Suvla sector because Australians didn't really serve in this sector. But they give a really interesting cross section of Australian service outside the main actions that were going on at Anzac.
Yeah.
So one of them is Chief Petty Officer Edward Perkins, who served with the Royal Australian Naval Bridging Train. Now, there's a number of photos in the Australian War Memorial collection of the Naval Bridging Train doing their work. So they were engineers that were sent up to Suvla to help build piers and construct things for the base there. And so they were sent up the 9th of August. They began working on piers up at Suvla, and they were the only Australian unit to stay permanently in the Suvla sector. And they lost 60 men during the course of the Suvla campaign, but only four of those men were killed in action. The others were wounded or evacuated sick. Chief Petty Officer Perkins is the only member buried on the peninsula. So that's the only Royal Naval Bridging Train grave you'll find on the peninsula. He was killed by shell fire on the 6th of September. Another interesting grave is Lance Corporal Herbert Peters, and he served with the 8th Light Horse, the 8th Australian Light Horse. Now, if we know our Gallipoli history, we know it was the 8th and the 10th Light Horse who were involved in the disastrous charge at the Neck during the August offensive. So there's not a lot of people who said, I'm from the 8th Light Horse and we're still serving after August. But he was. He'd survived the charge. He was in the charge at the neck and he survived and then was sent as a scout up to join the British and then was killed by shellfire himself on the 30th of August, which is really disappointing. And then there was that's very bad luck for him. But then there's a corporal, Hubert Govett, who was from Geelong, but served with the British, with the Royal Engineers. So he was living in England when the war broke out. He joined the Royal Engineers. He was sent to Gallipoli. And he was killed, Pete, I can't believe it, on the 19th of December, 1915, the day Suvla was evacuated, day Suvla and Anzac were both evacuated. So he is officially one of the last men killed in the Suvla sector, and he was an Australian. So check out, well, actually, second corporal, which is a rank I'm not familiar with, but second corporal Hubert Govett. So he's buried up there as well at Hill 10. Second corporal, have you come across that before, Pete?
Yeah, I have. It's a cavalry rank. It's it's one of those ranks connected to mounted troops, I think. Yeah.
Great. Thank you for that. Very interesting. This is another good spot here. You can follow some tracks down to the water's edge, and we're going to do that now for one really important reason, because there's some rocky outcrops, and this was actually the site known as Suvla Base. This was the main base of operations. And again, if you look online, there's incredible maps showing how complicated this was. A little mini city on the water's edge, because obviously there was a lot of liaison between the Navy and the Army to bring troops and supplies in and send wounded men off. And I think even compared to Anzac or North Beach in the Anzac sector, this was a really sophisticated operation that was going on here. Lots of piers, storehouses, little warehouses, almost a semi-permanent settlement was built here called Suvla Base. But if you walk around a couple of the little outcrops, a couple of little rocky bays, and you climb up on a headland, you look down and there's the wreck of a very large boat. You can just see the frame of the boat in the water. And it's actually the remains, incredibly, of a Beetle landing craft. Probably the only example, Pete, anywhere around. I mean, it's a wreck. It's not in any good condition.
Yep.
But this was the Beetle landing craft, was how lots of men came ashore at Suvla. It was the forerunner of landing craft that are still used today. It had a big ramp in the front so it could drive up on the sand. The ramp would come down and the men would come off. So we saw a lot of them, obviously, D-Day during the Pacific landings of World War II. And even today, this is still the way that landing craft are used, run up on beaches and a ramp comes down in the front. I mean, it's pretty obvious to us today. But compared to men scrambling over the sides of lifeboats during the Anzac and Helles landings, this was quite a revolution, Pete. Did you, in your time, Pete, ever have experience with these sorts of landing craft?
Yeah. We trained with landing craft, so I certainly did. It's still the recognised way to get ashore. Nowadays, tend to be mechanised, so still the vehicle, you know, the landing craft comes in, but you tend to now be in a vehicle that leaves rather than individually in sections or troops. I just like relics. I think people will have got the gist who have listened to these podcasts before, that poking about and looking at relics and things is fascinating. I just love that tactile nature. And here we have something that, depending on the tides, that we can actually see very clearly, the Beetle landing craft. But all around us is well worth having a rummage, as I like to say. Because this was a big storage area, there's all sorts of bits of the SRD jars again and bottles and things. It's just an interesting place because so many people were crammed into this very small area.
We'll post some photos of the Beetle landing craft because it is quite extraordinary to see one
there. Oh, it is. Yeah.
It's you know, there must be a preserved one somewhere, you would think, in the world, in a museum or something, but I certainly have never seen one. But here is a wreck, and it's a big one too. The wrecks at Gallipoli are normally, there's quite a few wrecks of landing craft and boats and things, but they tend to be just bits of metal. But this is a full, you can see the full, it's the full boat below the waterline. It's pretty impressive. I've got a quote here just describing the Beetle, because it was quite a, the men were in awe when they saw how these things came down, especially the ones who'd seen the landings at Anzac and Helles and the disaster they were. So they were quite amazed by this new technology. So here's a description. They were bulletproof, could carry 500 men each, and had long ramps at the bows. Okay, now I think there's a couple of inconsistencies here. I don't think they were bulletproof, and I certainly don't think they could carry 500 men, but there we go. They were bulletproof, could carry 500 men each, and had long ramps at the bows down which the troops could disembark in a matter of minutes when the boats grounded. This removed the nightmare of April 25th. This time there would be no pathetic gaggles of rowing boats tolling ashore under fire, but fast armoured landing craft capable of landing a division in a few hours. The arrival of the lighters at Mudros in July, at once called Beetles by the sailors on account of long projecting arms of the landing ramps, which resembled antenna, and their black paint, removed GHQ's greatest anxiety about a new landing. Well, it's a shame that it's a shame it removed their anxiety about a new landing, because they should have been slightly more anxious than they were. Maybe they would have made a better job of it. They were pretty large craft. I mean, I'm looking at a photo here now. They're pretty big craft. I doubt you could get 500 men on them, but a lot of men. You could get a lot of people.
I think there are others, aren't there? There's a sunk out at sea. I know just recently the Turkish authorities have been doing a survey of all the relevant shipping that's sunk in the area. I think they're all been making sure that they're going to be preserved or as much as they can. And I think there are others out at sea that you can actually dive upon, I think.
Yeah, diving at Gallipoli is a new popular pastime.
It is.
I'll absolutely put that on my list next time I'm there, because there are some impressive wrecks to see in pretty shallow water, as was the nature of the entire campaign. Pretty impressive. Yeah. You don't have to dive for this one, though. You can see it just by standing on the shore, and it's pretty amazing. Indeed. We'll definitely put a photo up. We're going to go past the bay and past Suvla Bay, so we're going to head up just to the point of land that sticks out, and this is the point of Suvla Bay, the most, I won't say the most northerly point, but certainly the most protruding point. And from here, if you go all the way to the end, you can look back definitely into the back of Anzac Cove and all the way up to Helles, effectively. You can see Archie Barber on a clear day, and you can see the British landing beaches off in the distance. So you can imagine the view that Turkish observers had here. And so because it's such a prominent point, the Turks have erected a memorial, as they do at key points around the battlefields, which are always great to visit. And the inscription on this one reads, "The enemy forces which landed at Araburnu," which is Anzac Cove, "on the morning of 25 April 1915, and Anafada Harbour," which is Suvla Bay, "on the night of 6-7 August 1917, realised after months of bloody fighting that they could not break through the Turkish defences on the Gallipoli Peninsula. They therefore abandoned these fronts on 20 December." So, yeah, triumphant from the Turks, but with good reason. They did absolutely
all very factual.
Our butts.
Yeah, all very factual.
Very factual. That's actually quite well done. I'm reading that now, when they say they realised after months of bloody fighting that they would not be able to break through the Turkish defences. It's actually a fairly restrained way to portray that from the Turkish position, because they could well have said, we, you know, drove the invaders into the sea and all those sorts of things. So it's a good spot. And it's a great view up the coast, see all the way up the coast to Cape Helles, which is 30 kilometres away. So pretty impressive. We're going to... Anything to add about Suvla Point, Pete?
No,
I've stood there. I've stood there with you. I remember standing there beside you, looking out over the view. It's a good spot.
Correct. I was just about to say that I have a great memory of that view.
We had a great time at Suvla, didn't we? The first time we went there together in 2013, I think it probably was, and a bunch of historians.
We had Peter Hart with us, didn't we? I think. I think he was leading us. In fact,
it's always a fun time when you're there with Peter Hart. So we had a great time. Yeah.
We did.
It's always good when historians get together and explore the ground. Many differing opinions.
It was great.
We're going to head back now. We're going to visit one, probably my favourite cemetery, definitely at Suvla, and one of my favourites at Gallipoli. This is the highly isolated, very little visited Azmak Cemetery, which is named after the valley that runs in front of it. It's another concentration cemetery built after the war, 1,074 graves, and as you'd expect, 684 of those unknown. And so this really marks on the left of the line, the furthest British advance. So we're almost in the foothills now of the ridges that surround Suvla. So this was the really desperate fighting when the British troops were just trying to get that high ground, and the Turks were reinforcing, and once again the Turks had the high ground. We were attacking uphill. Echoes of disasters on the Somme front, Pete, that, you know, we're fighting our way uphill against a dug-in enemy. Again, just a stuff up. And This is the most northerly Commonwealth cemetery at Gallipoli, and absolutely by far the least visited. And just to give an example of that, I was reading an account from a historian who went here. This was in 1970, visited the cemetery, got chatting to the gardener, and the gardener said, "You're the first visitor I've seen in 3 years to this cemetery." Things have improved a little bit since then, but not by much. So when I was doing the notes for this book in 2008, my Gallipoli guidebook, I went there again with Kenan Celik, the great Turkish guide. And that was only the second time he'd been there all year. This was in November 2008. This was the second time he'd been to this cemetery in the whole year. And he is on the peninsula every day. He would do multiple visits to Lone Pine and the Helles Memorial in a day, often. So the fact that he'd only been here twice in a year is really quite extraordinary. So when you go to Suvla, dear listener, please make sure you make the effort. It is quite an effort to get up this far, but go to Asmack Cemetery. Did we go there, Pete? I can't remember. We must have gone there.
No, I don't think I've been. I was thinking about it, and I've got a feeling that we were running out of time. Not sure, that makes to be sense. Absolutely
yeah,
truthful.
No, I think you're right. I think we did Hill 60 and then a few of the northern cemeteries and went down to Bay Beach, but I don't think we got this far for this very reason. It's a long way away. But, part of the reason you've got to go, especially if you're British, Pete, is one of the great mysteries of the Gallipoli campaign. Now, this is an extraordinary story. The Sandringham Company of the 1st, 5th Norfolks. Now, Sandringham, as in the royal estate, still a royal estate, these were people who worked with the king on the royal estate. So you want to talk about the ultimate pals battalion or the ultimate pals company. Yeah. Absolutely extraordinary. Is there anything you want to say about the Sandringhams before we get started with their story?
Yes, it's really a non-story that became a story. So even at the time, they really knew what had happened to them. But it's these newspapers. It's very typically newspapers of the time started really developing a kind of a mystery story about what had happened to the Sandringham Battalion. And all sorts of various theories were kind of spoken about, and then those theories were exaggerated, and before we know it, they're walking into the mist and disappearing, and then they're going to be, bodies will be found, and they've been executed by the Turks, and they were all captured, and in fact, it's no different than any battalion that gets itself isolated, cut off, some getting back, some not, some being taken prisoner, an awful lot killed. Now, I have to say the Turks were not always that keen on taking prisoners, but there were stories of when they were clearing the areas that they found lots of men who had been shot in the back of the head. Not true. It's a made-up story. Even the stories of the mass graves supposedly found created by the Turks, not really true. It's in the clearances. They found a lot of the bodies in gullies where they'd actually been thrown by the farmers as they cleared the land and wanted to get back on their land. And once we'd left and they were not overly careful with bodies and just threw them into gullies. So there's all sorts of stories, most of which now have been discounted. So I'm just going to read a couple of accounts from newspapers at the time, and then one from Charles Pierpoint Edwards, who was actually the chaplain involved in the recovery of the bodies in 1918-19. So I'll start with the Lynn News. This is a local newspaper. Only those in the firing line who were able to continue the advance when the other regiments in the brigade had come to a standstill. Most were taken prisoner, and it seemed to me that the great mystery about the whole thing is that so many of us got back at all. And that's Lance Corporal 2414 Ray Towler. He's one of those that managed to regain his lines and was not taken prisoner and not killed. And he's just commenting on the fact that it's amazing anybody got back. The battalion chaplain, as I mentioned, Reverend Charles Pierpoint Edwards, we have found the 5th Norfolks. There were 180 in all, 122 Norfolk and a few Hants and Suffolks with the 2nd of the 4th Cheshires. We could only identify two, Private Barnaby and Carter. They were scattered over an area about 1 square mile at a distance of at least 800 yards behind the Turkish front line. Many of them had evidently been killed in a farm, as a local Turk who owns the place told us that when he came back, he found the farm covered with decomposing bodies of British soldiers, which he threw into a small ravine. The whole thing quite bears out the original theory that they did not go very far on, but got mopped up one by one, all except the ones who got into the farm. Just a matter of interest, the two mentioned in his report, Corporal 2624 John Augustus Barnaby had enlisted in East Derrynham. And he was 24, and Private 1028 Walter Carter was born in Retton and was 22. Both are now laid to rest in Asmack Cemetery, where we're standing. And so those are two that were actually identified. And even on the Gallipoli Association website, this is a few years ago now, many wounded, disorientated and exhausted men were returned back to the British lines over the next few days. Surviving the war as prisoners were at least two officers and 31 other ranks from the brigade's attack, also adding to the surviving numbers. The final casualty figures of the 1st of the 5th Norfolks were adjusted to 15 officers and 141 men killed on the 12th of August, which is actually an appalling casualty rate, of which only Captain Beck and 16, now this is interesting, only Captain Beck and 16 men were recruited from the Sandringham estate. This is the fact and not the myth. So there's a lot of debunking of the myth, which to a certain extent spoils the story a bit.
Yeah, that's disappointing. I think
it is. But I think it's important that we do kind of tell the real story. And it's a story that will be repeated on the Western Front over and over again. And it matches a little bit the story of the Australian battalion, and I can't remember which one, fighting at Celtic Wood. Which is part of the battlefield near Broodsint.
It's the 10th Battalion.
Is it 10th? Yeah. And they have a similar story, don't they, Matt? Got overrun, they went ahead of everybody else, got isolated and eventually wiped out and cut off and wiped out.
Yeah, well, these stories sell papers, and especially their association with the King, that men from the company, you know, they're called the Sandringham Company, you know, association with the King. There was an air of mystery about the whole thing, but I think you're right. The men advanced forward. They advanced ahead of their comrades on either side of them, got behind the Turkish lines and were surrounded, cut off, and many were killed or wounded. Fascinating story. Regardless of mystery or not, it's a very interesting story. And this is you're actually looking out on the ground where the Sandringhams advanced when you're at Asmack Cemetery. And some of them are buried there in the cemetery. So it's an interesting spot.
Yep, they are.
And undoubtedly, all of them are buried in the cemetery. There's nowhere else for them to be. So all the Sandringhams are in the cemetery. We just don't know which grave belongs to which man.
Yeah, exactly.
So an interesting story. Just another thing I wanted to say about this cemetery is because it's so little visited, the times I've been there, the headstones were very faded, really faded, you know, almost beyond being able to be read. And I know that Commonwealth War Graves are in the process of upgrading headstones around the world, not just in Gallipoli. But I don't know if it's been done here yet at Asmack. So actually, if you're listening and have been to Asmack Cemetery recently, drop us a line on social media and tell us how the headstones are looking, because I have not been there for several years. And the headstones were desperately in need of renovation. So hopefully that's been done by now.
Yeah.
Good spot.
Yeah.
You should all. Asmack is a place I really like going to.
Yeah.
Okay. We're going to leave the cemetery now. We're going to. Sorry, did you have something to add there, Pete?
No. I was just going to say, and I look forward to going. Yeah. It's a place that I'd really like to get to.
We're going to leave the cemetery and now talk about Isolated. We are really getting into the weeds now, because we are going to drive up into the hills. And now this is an area that the British effectively never really took. There was some scrappy Isolated fighting up here, but this was really an area that was occupied by the Turks. We're going to drive up a very, very, very rough track for a long way, 6 kilometres or so. And eventually we're going, long after we think that we must have missed a turn, which is always the case in Gallipoli. You think, 3 kilometres ago, I must have missed the turn off or something. But eventually you will come to the memorial we're looking for. And this is the Turkish Jandarma Memorial. Extremely isolated, but certainly well worth visiting. And Peter Hart, occasionally on his walking tours, brings people up here to an area nearby known as the Boot. And it is he always talks about it as the most ridiculous walk you can do at Gallipoli to get up here. I have never done the walk, thank God, with Peter Hart, but I have certainly driven up here, and it is very isolated and very rough country. It's very rocky, these hills, very sharp, isolated ridges. And there's a Turkish memorial up here, the Jandarma Memorial. Jandarma, as in the military police, the equivalent of the gendarme that we talk about in France.
Yeah.
The Jandarma Memorial. So this is a group of Jandarma military police who stopped a British attack in the early days up here, and they're buried in a cemetery here. There's also quite a striking memorial made out of painted artillery shells that are up here, so it's a really good spot to come and pay our respects to the Turks, but it also offers some incredible views that you don't normally get at Gallipoli, which is out in the other direction, which is up towards Greece. So you look all the way up to the Greek coast up here, so it's absolutely extraordinary, a beautiful view of the Aegean, and quite an isolated spot. And just to give you an indication, another one of our quotes, this was a British soldier who fought not quite in this spot, but very nearby. It was two areas called Kidney Hill and the Pimple, which were up here on these ridges. And here was his description. He was actually a stretcher bearer, and here's what he saw. That hillside was a shambles. Evidently, there had been fierce hand-to-hand fighting there a few hours ago. Rifles, kits, water bottles, khaki, Turkish tunics and headgear were strewn everywhere among the scrub. While we were following a phantom-like voice, we came suddenly onto a half-dug trench, which an RAMC officer had made into a combined mortuary and first aid station. There we set furiously to work, sorting out the dead from the living. There reeled among us, out of the darkness, an officer raving, "My men have taken that bloody hill, but they're dying of thirst." He passed on, and we continued our ghastly work. It just, it gives a great illustration, that quote, Pete, of disorganisation. You know, he used the word shambles. Just, what, Pete, you're a military man, what does it mean to military men to be in that situation? No one knows what's going on. The officers are going half mad. There's dead and wounded everywhere. There's aid stations being set up to try and deal with the influx of bleeding men. How do you fight in that environment?
Well, it's very difficult, and I think that's why you need well-trained men. And of course, this is something that a lot of these guys are not fully trained. Certainly, the Kitchener men have had very rudimentary training, and this is where discipline training comes into play. One of the things we haven't mentioned, of course, is this is the height of summer, and we know what it's like for those that have been, you know, been on the peninsula in the height of summer is not the best time to go, because it is just so hot, and the supply of water to these guys was very difficult. And in that account that you just read, Matt, that's the first time we've heard somebody desperately looking for water. Because, of course, the men, certainly after combat and during combat, you drink enormous amounts of water. It's one of the comments my son, who fought in Afghanistan, and during his first combat, he remembered that by midday he'd drunk all of his water. He'd actually emptied his camelback without even realising he was drinking it. And of course, nowadays you have a straw that you suck, goes into your camelback, and the water's carried on your back. And so he hadn't even noticed he'd been drinking it. But you could, because you're in combat, your mouth is dry all the time. It's just something you automatically do. And so these guys, obviously, the majority would have drunk their water again by midday. But whereas my son was resupplied during that evening, these guys will probably have to wait till they actually leave the line, so they're relieved and go back to before they can actually get a resupply of water. So very, very important that you have discipline in the way that you drink water and use water. And these guys are just not that well trained. So I think, a combination of that, ammunition, of course, another issue, and those will be what will bring despair and panic, is lack of water, lack of ammunition, and lack of knowledge of what's going on. So all of those things important to infantrymen who especially have been isolated.
Yeah, great points. Thanks for that, Pete. I mean, I think the word shambles sums that up pretty clearly.
Yeah.
So we're going to drive all the way back down past Asmak. We're actually going to head all the way back towards Green Hill Cemetery. And before we get there, we're going to take a left, and we're going to head really right up the middle of the Suvla sector to a site of courage, sacrifice, ghastliness. It's not much to look at today. It's a hill with three Turkish memorials on top of it, but this is the famous Scimitar Hill. This was the last organized Allied attack at Gallipoli, the 21st of August 1915, and actually the largest. More troops were employed in the attack on Scimitar Hill, the combined attack on Scimitar Hill and Hill 60, which we talked about in our last podcast. Both took place on the 21st of August 1915. Disastrous, ghastly. Even Winston Churchill referred to these as the biggest and the last attack at Gallipoli. What can we say about Scimitar Hill, Pete? The British had occupied it on the 8th of August during the landing. They gave it up to the Turks freely to bring troops back to the beach. Then they had to attack it again on the 21st. Just a disaster. The scrub caught fire. Wounded men were burnt to death in the scrub. It was just an awful thing. And we did not capture Scimitar Hill. It's just a ghastly, ghastly attack.
It's one that I've known about for a long, long time. When I first joined the Royal Marines, our training bases are tend to be in Dorset and Devon, I became very interested in the Dorset Yeomanry, and They fought there with the 2nd Mounted Division, which is the South Midlands Mounted Brigade. And this is where they have the... It doesn't sound like a great number compared to what we've been looking at. 45 men killed. But, of course, these are guys that are normally riding horses. And, of course, here they've been dismounted for the fighting here. Like everybody else, hadn't really got a great idea of what was going on. Lack of water. And for them, it's... When we talk about the Dorset Yeomanry and their experiences in the Great War, this is the one that we always go to, the fighting on the 21st and the attack on Scimitar Hill. So it's something that I've always been interested in. It fills me with both admiration for those that fought there and the horror of the organisation planning and the lack of water, I think, is the worst aspect of the fighting during this day. It is men that survived it was in terrible states due to lack of water.
One time I went up to Scimitar Hill on a visit to Gallipoli, and there'd been a fire that had come through, a grass fire had come through fairly recently, and the trenches that were exposed, Turkish positions, it was incredible. And the relics left over from the fighting, and it's all just there below the scrub. And so that was absolutely extraordinary. For probably 6 months or so, everyone was talking about get to Scimitar Hill and explore the trench system. Fortunately, we now have the opportunity to do that in a bit more organized fashion, because the Turkish authorities are clearing sections of trench, which I think is fantastic. And check out our video on YouTube that Peter Hart and I made, which was exploring the trenches of Gallipoli, which was on Silt Spur next to Lone Pine in the Anzac sector. So I think it's brilliant. The Turks are clearing scrub away from sectors of trenches to expose the trenches, but they're leaving the roots of the trees in place to hold the soil in place, and then it'll be exposed for a year or two, and then eventually nature will reclaim it and they go and clear another sector. I think it's fantastic, and I didn't realise how much of the Gallipoli trench systems remained beneath the scrub until you see things like Scimitar Hill after a fire, or the newly cleared areas at Silt Spur. Just extraordinary. There's it's not a lot of glory at Scimitar Hill. There's not a lot to say about the fighting there. Really, the final bleak chapter of the whole campaign.
I think one of the things I've always, again, it's one of those stories that goes back right the way to my childhood. And I think it was probably in The Victor or one of those comics that I used to take as a young lad. And it was of one of the yeomanry troopers, Trooper Frederick Potts, doing an act that he will be awarded the Victoria Cross for. And that's even though he'd been shot in the thigh himself. So he can't carry anybody, but he devises, I think, a cunning device of putting a wounded soldier on a shovel and then dragging the shovel, using it as a sled. And I remember reading this in a comic as a young man and thinking, God, that's clever. You know, not one of these kind of grab a bayonet and a rifle and charge the enemy single-handedly. This is about getting people off the battlefield. And I just thought it was a clever use of a shovel, one which saved a man's life.
Well, there are only two Victoria Crosses awarded during the campaign at Suvla. And both were at this spot at Scimitar Hill. So that one, Frederick Potts, on the 21st of August during this attack we described. But on the attack on the 9th of August, when the British first occupied the hill, Captain Percy Hanlon rescued six wounded men under very heavy fire and was awarded the Victoria Cross. Again, Pete, we discussed this in our Pozieres episode with Claude Castleton's VC, but it 1915 really marked that shift, didn't it, in the reasons that the Victoria Cross was given. Because even when we were talking about Brigadier General Kenner buried in Lalababa Cemetery, his VC that he'd won in the Sudan was also for rescuing wounded. We see two VCs here for rescuing wounded. We saw Claude Castleton in 1916 for rescuing wounded, but from 1916 onwards. I did look that up after the Pozieres episode, Pete, and it was just after Claude Castleton in July 1916. Just after that, they made a new rule. Okay, too many VCs are being given for rescuing wounded. No more for rescuing wounded. You have to get a VC now for an act of gallantry in furthering your unit's objectives. But again, here what we're seeing is VCs being awarded for what I think is incredible bravery, rescuing wounded.
Yeah.
It's quite a great
spot. Innovation. That's what I like here.
Remember that. If you're ever somewhere and you need an improvised sled, grab the nearest shovel. Follow the example of Fred Potts. We're nearing the end, Pete. I mean, Scimitar is a very sad place. Again, I can't help but thinking of those wounded men burnt to death in the fires. Awful stuff. And it feels like that when you're there. It's not a very glorious spot. The Turkish memorials record the landing, the fighting there on the 9th of August, and the fighting on the 21st, the last chapter of the Gallipoli campaign. We're going to head a little bit further north There's a village called Anafata, Burak Anafata, and we're going to head up there. Interestingly, because just on the outskirts of the town, as we drive through the town and then come out the other side, there are two extremely large Turkish guns still on their mounts, loosely in the position. So the guns are where they were after the campaign, but the gun emplacements have sort of been rebuilt around them to give an indication of what they were like. But it's fascinating they're still here, Pete, because these are the guns that are described by the Anzacs as Anafata Annie, they called the shells that came. You know, they the battery was called Anafata Annie, and the one at the south was Beachy Bill, and the ones in the north were Anafata Annie, and the guns are still there. It's extraordinary. So they're pointing at Suvla now because they originally started firing at the Anzacs on the first day of the campaign, and then they swung them north to fire on the beaches of Suvla. But just great to see these huge, they're absolutely massive artillery guns in place. And here's someone who was at Anzac and described hearing the shells come in from Anafata Annie. The first thing one hears is a noise like the rending of linen, or perhaps the rush of steam describes it better. This gets louder and louder, and then as the projectile nears the end of its journey, one hears a whine, half whistle, half scream, and then the explosion. If it is very near, there is an acrid smell in the air. One's feelings are difficult to describe. You duck your head instinctively, you feel absolutely helpless, wondering where the thing will burst. And as you hear the explosion, a quick wave of feeling sweeps over you as you murmur, "Thank heaven, not this time." And doesn't that sum up the feeling of men under shell fire?
It does. It does indeed.
Just random and horrific. So that's the guns of Anafata Annie, and they're still there. You can go and visit them today and scramble all over them and take your photo.
It's one of the great aspects of the whole of the peninsula, the number of guns that are still there. And I think obviously the only reason they're there is because getting them out and scrapping them will be so difficult that it was not worth the effort. So they're still there. So it's one of the great things. There are an awful lot of the batteries from the fighting on the peninsula still in place.
Especially these big old guns. I think because it was early during the First World War, relatively early during the First World War, there was a lot of, you know, scraping together of whatever equipment they could find on both sides. And so, you know, obsolete naval guns and, you know, all sorts of things. So by the time the campaign was over and, you know, the Turks were obviously the occupiers, there was no need for an old, you know, 1902 naval gun to be pressed into service. So they just left them where they were. The French guns down at Helles are also well worth seeing for that same reason, the famous French battery, the guns that the Allies destroyed when they left. Pete, that's pretty much the end of the Suvla tour. We can drive back down now to the coast and take a left, and we'll be heading back towards Anzac. We've come a long way. It's a long drive back to Anzac. And then once you're at Anzac, we still know it's a long drive back to a cold beer waiting for you in a Charbert or Chinakali. So it's a long way north up here, but really well worth doing. It's the I won't say the untold story of the Gallipoli campaign, but certainly the misunderstood story of the Gallipoli campaign. And you gain an incredible perspective by walking this ground that we've just done. It's a great spot, isn't it, Pete?
It is. And it goes right the way back to my my interest in it. It goes right the way back to my early collecting years. So I was probably around about 6 or 7 years old, collecting comical cards of the Great War. One of my favourites at that time was a picture of a soldier, and emblazoned above him as "We are the boys of Suvla Bay." And I remember it fired my imagination at the time, and I suppose it still does, really. Yeah.
And there was a lot of confusion as well. You read newspaper articles describing the Anzac landing, and I think Suvla was the only identifiable landmark on the peninsula in the early days of the campaign. So there was a lot of misunderstanding that the Anzac troops had come ashore at Suvla, and obviously reinforced by Eric Bogle's wonderful song, the band played "Waltzing Matilda."
Oh, yeah.
But there was a lot of misunderstanding. You read that in early newspapers as well. It's just a fascinating story, and it's a fascinating place to visit. So please, when you go to Gallipoli, walk the ground and discover the ghosts of Suvla. It's a wonderful journey.
Yeah,
Pete, like always, thank you so much for your input. It's been great walking this ground with you.
No, very enjoyable, Matt.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you would like to support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do it. Firstly, you can become a member. For a small monthly fee, you could subscribe to the show and listen to every episode ad-free, and also receive exclusive episodes directly from Pete and I. So see the link in the show notes to sign up at Acast Plus and become a member of the show. Also, if you want to make a one-off contribution, you can now buy us a coffee. visit buymeacoffee.com/battlewalks and you can make a small contribution there. See you next week.